Wait, I'm unbuttoning my pants before we record.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I got the stretchy pants on.
Oh, that's ready. Better. Beautiful. Woo. All right.
All right. Now that our pants are undone.
Let's go.
Hello, and welcome to... I can't. Let me start again. Hello, and welcome to Gender Troubles. I'm Emma Austin.
I'm Eva Espenshade.
And we majored in gender studies.
So you don't have to.
We are on Twitter at GenderTroubles1, and we're on Instagram at gender.troubles.pod, and we have a Patreon, which is patreon.com/gender_troubles.
And Gender Troubles is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Harbinger brings you progressive podcasts from all across Canada, and you can find them at harbingermedianetwork.com. Also, in May, we are doing Porn Month. So we are having some guests on, and we are dedicating the month to discussing pornography and different feminist perspectives on the porn industry and porn work. So keep an eye out for that in your podcasting feed.
Porn Month.
Porn Month.
So what are we talking about today, Eva?
Today, we are talking about surrogacy. I started thinking about surrogacy kind of on like a more for personal reasons. So as you know, and some people might know, I have a medical condition called adenomyosis, where I have endometriosis cells inside the lining of my uterus, making my uterus like a inflamed, hostile, boggy place and causing me a lot of pain. And so in 2 weeks now, almost, I'm getting a hysterectomy. Which was a whole process to get, and that's another episode. But one part of the hysterectomy is because I'm so young, I still have my ovaries, and so I am my own like egg freezer. Sometimes, if people, you know, have hysterectomy or have ovarian cancer or something, they might choose to, you know, have some of their eggs frozen in case they want to have biological children through a surrogate. And I won't need to do that, but I hadn't really considered having a surrogate because I have no desire to have children to begin with. Mm-hmm. And it's very expensive, but hypothetically, if I had a whole change of heart, I would be able to potentially, you know, hire a surrogate and have a biological child. Mm-hmm. So then I started thinking about surrogacy more and kind of went down this deep dive. And in general, like, this topic gets really heated really quickly because we're talking about babies and families, and it hits home for a lot of people. And I feel like, you know, I feel slightly unqualified talking so much about like pregnancy and stuff as like a non, and like parenting as a non-mother, but I hope that kind of by showing my positionality on the issue as a about to be infertile woman shows that I kind of have some skin in the game beyond just kind Definitely. Of like a theoretical feminist perspective. And in researching this episode, I like found so many books and articles with like really like attention grabbing headlines, like babies for sale, like selling the womb.
Of course.
And there aren't any like real statistics on how many babies are born through surrogacy a year. But like the general understanding is that like the demand for and the frequency for surrogacy is growing. Mm-hmm. And you can attribute this to like a bunch of different things. Like one thing, like people, especially women, are delaying becoming parents to focus on kind of life and career. Having children is expensive. And more countries are legalizing gay marriage and kind of by extent gay parenting. And there's been giant advancements in reproductive technologies. And surrogacy has also become like a lot more socially acceptable than it was when it began kind of in the modern age in the 80s.
Yeah, I feel like Kim K made it like fashionable.
Yes.
You know, or like, oh, I guess it's okay.
Exactly. Like typically with surrogacies that we hear about in the news, it's celebrities.
Yeah.
And it's normally like a woman who has suffered complications from a previous pregnancy, like Kim Kardashian or like Grimes. Or it's like a gay man becoming a father. So like Anderson Cooper, Andy Cohen. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where we're at in terms of socially. I think surrogacy has come a long way, though you still have a lot of people who will bring up like, well, why didn't you adopt? And I'll get into that a little bit more. But
right.
So some terms. There are two different types of surrogacy. There's traditional, which is also known as natural or partial. So you use natural or artificial insemination. And an egg comes from the person who is carrying the fetus, and the sperm right. comes from presumably the person who wants to become a father. And then you have gestational or host or full surrogacy. And this is where an embryo is created from IVF and it's implanted into someone who's going to carry the fetus. Mm-hmm. So the carrier becomes essentially like a human incubator. Mm-hmm. And this first happened in 1986.
Wow, that's so late. I didn't realize that it was like... That actually is a very recent technology.
It is. There's altruistic surrogacy, where kind of a surrogate is motivated by a desire to help a couple or an individual have a child. So you might be compensated for like medical costs, loss of income, but not for like the labor of gestating a baby.
Right.
And then there's commercial surrogacy, where typically a surrogate is recruited through an agency. And the prospective parents pay for both medical costs and gestational labor, along with kind of agency fees and some sort of stipend for the surrogate.
I get targeted advertisements to become a surrogate all the time.
Really? Normally you have to have had most surrogates. They want you to have a kid beforehand.
Mm. Yeah, I get targeted ads. I think it's because like I worked in childcare for so long. So I think like the algorithm thinks that I have kids. I get targeted ads for surrogacy and for egg donation all the time.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of those things where I'm like, oh, don't need to worry about that anymore. Yeah. Can't have that job. Read an article that apparently the shampoo I'm using, they're like, ooh, it might be linked to infertility. I was like, oh shit. And I was like, oh wait, that doesn't matter for me. This is great.
I don't have to worry anymore.
I don't need to worry anymore.
Yeah.
But surrogacy has been kind of happening since forever. Like the first recorded surrogacy arrangement is the story of Sarah, Abraham, and Hagar in the book of Genesis. So here's a quote from the book of Genesis. Now Sarai, Abraham's wife, bore him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar, not sure. And Sarai said unto Abraham, behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. Go in, I pray thee, unto my handmaiden. It may be that I shall be built up through her. And Abraham hearkened the voice of Sarai.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did Hagar have any say in this?
No.
Like there wasn't a lot of consent.
No, there was definitely not. I mean, the Bible's not big on consent in general, yeah. I find. But yes, no, this was, but it's the first story of surrogacy. Yeah. So I wanted
to. Yeah, that's a long time ago. Yeah,
a long time ago. There's legislation that's different in like different countries. So commercial surrogacy is legal in places like Georgia, Israel, Ukraine, Russia, India, and California in the States. Though I think India actually just recently banned commercial surrogacy. It kind of changes pretty frequently. Mm-hmm. And in many places in the States, only like altruistic surrogacy is allowed. That's the same with Canada. So in Canada, you can hire a surrogate, but you're not paying for them gestating, just for medical expenses, etc. And then you have cross-border surrogacy. And so you'll have prospective parents going places like Russia, Ukraine, or India, where kind of IVF and surrogacy treatment is available. And I found from one study that it has been estimated that more than 25,000 children have been born to or to be born to surrogates in India, of which 50% are from the West. So it's very common to have a surrogacy arrangement where, well-to-do people come from the West specifically to India and hire a surrogate.
Yeah, there's this wild Radiolab episode and they talk about how what you're saying that like most couples that come from the West to places like India to get to have surrogacy, but they also first they go to Eastern Europe to get cheap white eggs is what they call them from places like Ukraine. And then that egg is then, but like the actual labor of like carrying the baby in Eastern Europe is still too expensive. So then they go to a place like India with their cheap white egg, not my words.
Yes.
and yeah, then they have like a person from India actually like carry the baby. Mm-hmm. So it's like this whole like transnational weird economy.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And we'll include that episode in the show notes.
For sure. It's really good. Yeah.
And I'm not really going to talk that much about transnational surrogacy, or it's also known as like fertility tourism, because mm-hmm. I think like that topic deserves like its own episode. Mm-hmm. So where I'm kind of coming from is looking at the history and how the legal system has thought of surrogacy, and then also how can we kind of as feminists and radicals think about surrogacy in a new way?
Cool.
Yeah. So there's like tiers to this topic and tiers to things we talk about when we talk about surrogacy. So a big one is, you know, issues around ownership and parentage. And a lot of the time in kind of anti-surrogacy literature, they talk about the Handmaid's Tale and quote-unquote slavery. And I see like really big waving red flags when anti-surrogacy folks invoke slavery into their arguments and metaphors, like, because there's a real issue with feminists, like especially white feminists, just like comparing everything to slavery.
I know, what is that? It's like enough already this weird allegory. It's not good.
Yeah like we can talk about things being, you know, exploitative and unethical and a bunch of other things and also not invoke slavery. Yeah. It's also typically trying to be like, oh, white women have it as bad as like enslaved people, and you're like, no, just and like also bringing this kind of slavery Handmaid's Tale argument like erases the complex history of Black women and their reproductive freedoms. Like, you can, and scholars have argued, for example, that like pre-American Civil War, essentially all Southern Black mothers were surrogate mothers. Like, mm-hmm. enslaved women gave birth to children, like, with the knowledge that those children would be owned by others. They had no kind of, you know, sense of family in that way. Mm-hmm. So here's what Angela Davis has to say on this matter. She goes, quote, slave women were birth mothers or genetic mothers, to employ terms rendered possible by the new reproductive technologies, but they possess no legal rights as mothers of any kind. Considering the commodification of their children and indeed of their own persons, their status was similar to that of the contemporary surrogate mother. I'm suggesting the term surrogate mother might be invoked as a retroactive description of their status.
Mm.
You will also have issues of kind of bioethics and feminist bioethics, and then debates around like who gets to be a parent, with like queer parenting, people who are opposed to that, you know, and the narratives around surrogacy being kind of sympathetic versus selfish. So a lot of the time, pro-surrogacy puff pieces from agencies, they'll talk about, you know, a cishet couple where the woman had like cancer and she became infertile, but they wanted a family. And so then a surrogate came and like made their dream come true.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the debate about like adoption versus surrogacy, where adoption is seen as being very altruistic and surrogacy is seen as being selfish, because presumably like the wanting to have like a biological child, you know, the whole rhetoric around like there's so many children out there already. And the whole adoption industry also has like a lot of fucked up stuff in it.
Yeah.
And we also have an issue when you talk about surrogacy of like how surrogacy is a proposed economic freedom for women who are living in poverty. And this is a lot with when we talk about like fertility tourism and transnational surrogacy, where surrogacy agencies will claim to what degree it's true or not, depends that, you know, women who are surrogates in a country, say like India, are going to make so much more as a surrogate than they would doing other forms of labor.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of comparisons too with surrogacy industries, to kind of like pimps, in the metaphor of like comparisons of surrogacy to sex work or prostitution, where anti-surrogate activists will really make these comparisons of the brokers for the surrogates, the people who are part of the agencies, are kind of the pimps of the of the whole operation.
Right.
And then we have stuff around gestational labor is labor. I mean, it's in the name and deserves like recognition and protection. And these tie to stuff around like wages for housework or like other mm-hmm. kind of mobilizations around feminine labor. And I do think there's really something to be said about with commercial surrogacy, placing a price on gestating a child can kind of bring up how fucking hard it is to be a pregnant person and to give birth.
Yeah.
Modern surrogacy, so we're not talking in the Bible, you know, we're talking since the 80s, kind of like it really threw a wrench in the legal system, especially in the United States. So I have a quote from the legal scholar Barbara Stark, and I was hoping you could read it, please.
For sure. Okay, here we go. Quote, pre-existing family law is inadequate to address surrogacy, in part because of the multiple parents and in part because of the breakdown in traditional parenting functions. State laws governing parentage, for example, generally provide that a woman giving birth is the child's legal mother. The birth mother does not lose her status as legal mother until and unless she voluntarily surrenders the baby. As a matter of law, a child cannot be surrendered for adoption before birth. The premise is that a mother cannot be certain that she wants to surrender the baby until he or she arrives. For this reason, several states have decided that traditional surrogacy contracts are unenforceable. Rather, the surrogate cannot be required to surrender a baby on the ground that she agreed to do so before it was born. These laws assume that the woman giving birth is also the baby's biological mother, that is, that the baby developed from her egg. When the baby is not the biological offspring of the surrogate, but rather biologically related to a separate egg donor, the law and the arguments change. Legislators have often left these sensitive issues to the courts.
Mm-hmm. So there were two really prominent legal cases on surrogacy in the states that really kind of set the precedent for modern surrogacy arrangements. So the first is the Baby M case, which happened in 1986 in New Jersey. So the broad strokes are in February of 1985, a man named Bill Stern, he kind of executed a surrogacy contract with this woman, Mary Beth Whitehead, who was already a mother and was kind of more working class. And she agreed to become their surrogate. And it was all brokered from the Infertility Center of New York and its director, Noel Keene. Later, after Miss Whitehead gave birth, she delivered the baby to Bill Stern and his wife, Elizabeth, and they named the baby Melissa. But then Mary Beth came back the next day and told them that she couldn't like live without the baby and she needed to spend a few more days with the baby. So they allowed that. And then her and Mary Beth and her husband took the baby to Florida to kind of hide out. She didn't want to give the baby up. And then they were apprehended and brought back to New Jersey. And then there was a huge court case where essentially Mary Beth argued that she could not give up this baby and the contract that they'd signed was unenforceable because she was getting paid to have this child. And that counts as like trafficking because she's getting paid to deliver a person. Bill Stern was saying this person was she signed a contract and she's now trying to negate on the contract. It was like a super highly publicized and messy trial that stretched over 2 months. And in the end, the judge said the surrogacy contract was valid and ordered that Mary Beth's parental rights be terminated and that Mr. Stern receive sole custody. And then kind of at the same time, the judge also entered an order allowing Mr. Stern's wife, Elizabeth, to adopt Melissa. Here is a clip from a news story after the fact.
It was a court battle between a New Jersey housewife named Mary Beth Whitehead and Bill Stern, a New York biochemist, and it became known worldwide as the Baby M trial. What ended in lengthy and highly controversial court proceedings all began in March of 1986 when Mary Beth Whitehead gave birth to a baby girl, a child that had been conceived through a surrogate contract. After the child was born, Mary Beth decided that she could no longer honor that contract and that to give up her child would be the equivalent of selling her child for $10,000, the amount agreed upon with the Stearns.
The 80s hair.
The 80s hair.
The feathering.
It's
wild.
Oh, God. I love any episode where we get a look back at old videos.
Yeah. It's like, how did they do that?
Hairspray. I feel like a lot of hairspray. Yeah. And with the case of Baby M, Mary Beth Whitehead was the biological mother she was artificially inseminated. But if we're looking at kind of a biological standpoint, baby M was 50% hers.
Right.
Compared to the other big legal case that happened a few years later, which was Johnson v. Calvert, which was in 1993 in California. And this was a situation where Mark and Crispina Calvert, who are a childless married couple, hired a woman, Anna Johnson, to enter into a contract where an embryo created from the couple, Mark and Crispina, would be implanted into Anna Johnson's uterus, and then she would be a surrogate mother. And then after giving birth, would relinquish all parental rights to the child. And in return, the couple would pay her a specified fee. So Anna Johnson became pregnant, but the relationship between her and the couple really deteriorated. And then Anna Johnson started suggesting that she might refuse to surrender the child when it was born. And so the couple sued for a declaration that they were the legal parents of the unborn child. And then the surrogate, Anna Johnson, filed her own action saying that she was the mother. This case kind of established that both genetic consanguinity and giving birth are both means of establishing a mother-child relationship. Before we had IVF, like, this wasn't an issue at all. But now that you could have someone gestating and giving birth to a baby who, you know, did not come from their egg, who shared no kind of biology with them, no genetic stuff with them, that really changed. Mm-hmm. And the courts also said that when two means do not coincide in one woman, the woman who intended to procreate the child and raise her as her own was the natural mother. Right. So in that case, that would be Crispina Calvert. And I guess natural mother is like a legal term. It sounds really weird to me. Sounds like, I don't know, like a 70s folk song, but
it invokes ecofeminist visions.
Yes,
I think.
Totally. And the Johnson v. Calvert was not really as highly publicized, but the Baby M case was really like a media circus shit show. And like everyone seemed to have an opinion and went on TV to discuss it with their fabulous hair, with all that hairspray. And they wrote about it in newspapers and magazines. And like some feminists supported like various types of surrogacy arrangements. But there was like a loud and very well organized opposition to surrogacy from feminist groups. So what you ended up with is having feminists standing in the anti-surrogacy camp next to like religious leaders and join their fight in this and only this issue. So here's a quote from feminist scholar Barbara Katz Rothman reflecting kind of on her life during this time. Do you want to read it, Emma?
Sure. During the Baby M case, I found myself caught up in the media circus surrounding the case and spent an amazing amount of time in green rooms with Noel King, the man who had brokered the surrogacy contract between Mr. and Mrs. Stern and Mr. and Mrs. Whitehead. I think I spent more time putting on my makeup for that particular surrogate broker than I did with my husband that year. I found that one of the interesting things that happened was the way that the media used me for something it called balance. The media would have carefully groomed surrogate and her broker on one side, and then on the other side, it would usually have a rabbi or a priest or a minister, and then me. The little tag that appeared in white letters on the television screen under me sometimes read author and sometimes read sociologist, but usually it read feminist, and so I was there to be the feminist balance.
Hmm. I think this quote is really interesting in part because, so having her talk about being on the kind of anti-surrogacy side next to religious leaders, and also the way she says that there'd be a carefully groomed surrogate and her broker, I think really speaks to this woman still isn't, you know, in many ways an anti-surrogate feminist. And the language of grooming ties into kind of other stuff around anti-surrogacy and people comparing surrogacy to, you know, sex trafficking.
Yeah.
So what were like the feminist arguments against surrogacy while the Baby M case was happening? So one feminist, Catherine B. Lieber, she writes about and worries about kind of the surrogacy industry of creating like a quote unquote breeding brothel approach to reproduction, or quote, white women who are judged superior would be selected as egg donors and turned into machines for producing embryos. Women of color would be used as breeders with artificial synchronization of menstrual cycles, perfecting the assembly line. This would continue until the development of the artificial womb, after which the breeder would no longer be of value. And if you talk about the cases you were saying in that Radiolab piece, you kind of have, I wouldn't use those terms, but you do have white, wealthy white Western couples having white eggs implanted into brown and black women to gestate the baby.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, definitely like white supremacy reigns, especially in like artificial reproduction.
Totally. And like, I, you know, it's a little bit of a sci-fi paranoia and all this stuff around like artificial wombs. But I do appreciate how the argument like draws attention to the racialized politics of surrogacy. Mm-hmm. And in Johnson v. Calvert, the couple who were the genetic parents, the father was white and the mother was white and Filipino, and the surrogate mother was black. And the Johnson v. Calvert case raised concerns about gestation becoming racialized labor. And parallels were drawn between this case and the history of black enslaved women's reproductive capacities.
Right.
Another critique of surrogacy is that women were getting like really contradictory information from society around pregnancy. So this is a quote from Gina Correa, who is the former co-chair of the National Coalition Against Surrogacy, where she says, "It is drilled into us in every conceivable way that we women have this maternal instinct, maternal love. We are told that if we have an abortion, we'll suffer great psychological trauma and a sense of loss. Now, with the advent of surrogacy, they're conditioning women to say, that's not my baby, it's your baby, because you paid for it. How fast they change. They switch propaganda on us as it suits their needs."
I mean, she's not wrong.
Yeah, again, I'm like, okay, yeah, totally not wrong.
Yeah.
And another big topic is the issue of kind of informed consent. Here, the issue of informed consent is more of like the drastic kind of hormonal changes that pregnant bodies go through. Mm-hmm. But then you have other feminists who like warn against this line of argument because women's hormones have been used against them for centuries. Like, we don't want to go back to kind of Victorian ideas of women being like so overwhelmed by their hormones that they need others, like men, to protect them from themselves.
Right.
And the response of the Baby M case was really just an example of American society like grappling with the transition away from the 1950s nuclear family. And it's also the time that politicians were like campaigning on the specter of the quote unquote welfare queen and policing black and brown families, along with kind of like lamenting women's lib and birth control legalizations and like the degradation of like family values. Mm-hmm. So it all kind of ties together in this kind of big moral panic around surrogacy. Mm-hmm. Another thing with the Baby M case that, you know, really drew a lot of feminist criticism is, from a legal standpoint, Bill Stern was the one who brought the suit against Mary Beth Whitehead and not also his wife, because Bill Stern was the biological father and Mary Beth Whitehead was the biological mother, but his wife Elizabeth was not. And so you had a real kind of argument over kind of patriarchy, you know, in the real true sense of the term, where you had a man, a father, arguing that he had rights over this baby in a way that the woman didn't. And that, you know, raised some alarm bells for feminists who have been really trying to push against that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, those are the two big kind of legal cases that kind of gave us the surrogacy kind of legislation we have here, though the kind of energy behind the anti-surrogacy movement really die down, especially around feminists, because a lot of the arguments that the anti-surrogacy movement was using and feminists were using in the 80s around the Baby M case was around kind of like regret and, you know, hormones and stuff, and that if you have a surrogate mother and you give birth, you're going to regret it and it's going to be traumatic. Which can and totally be true, but that's also the same argument that conservatives were using against abortion. So they could just turn around and use that argument against like a feminist issue. So that's an example where you don't see as many kind of anti-surrogate feminists along with having Kim Kardashian and people using surrogates more and reproductive technology becoming like more available and also more affordable to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Do we like know if, because it's, you can't pay a surrogate in some place like Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But like, is it still like racialized labor? Like, are there more surrogate women of color than there are like white surrogates?
I don't have the data on that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think with transnational surrogacy, definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm not quite sure as much in North America.
Like, I'm curious, like, who decides to be a surrogate in North America?
Yeah, and, like, I mean, yeah. There's you have a fair amount of religious women who choose to do it.
Right. Yeah.
In part of, like, you know, bringing the gift of life to other people.
Yes.
And when, you know, finding a surrogate, it's similar to kind of shopping around for like an egg donor or a sperm donor, but kind of more so because surrogates have to prove that they're really healthy. And a lot of the time, what makes them an appealing surrogate is that they're, you know, eat a vegan diet or they exercise or, you know, they're all that kind of stuff, which can also add to the value of that surrogate.
Right. But also, yeah, like I wonder about like the autonomy of a person's body when it's being used, when your body's being used to grow another person's baby. Mm-hmm. It's like, do they have a say over what you eat? And like, what if you want a glass of wine?
I think it really depends. But
yeah,
I mean, it's also interesting is just people who are pregnant for, you know, who aren't surrogates have talked about how alienating and strange pregnancy can be.
Right. Yeah.
And what's kind of remarkable is a body will gestate a baby, will gestate an egg into a baby or an embryo into a baby, like regardless of whether or not it shares any kind of genetics with it, which is kind of cool if you think about it. Like you can look at it as very kind of, you know, oh, artificial wombs and whatnot. But I think it's really just fucking cool that bodies are just like able to do that.
For sure. And it's true. Like your body for that like point in time kind of becomes not your own anymore, right?
It totally.
The amount of like blood and nutrients that a baby takes from its host. Because it's literally, you know, that kind of relationship. And like, yeah, like it like make people sick that are pregnant because it's like, yeah, you're having your nutrients diverted away from your own body and into the babies. It's wild. Mm-hmm. It's a wild selfless thing.
And it's weird to put a price tag on like a child.
For sure.
Like that's just, you know, feels really weird. And you know, people have done kind of like the hourly calculation of like how much you'd make as a surrogate per hour. And it's like it could be like 50 cents or something, which feels also really weird. Like there's no, when you have commercial surrogacy, it just, once you bring in kind of the capitalist mode into it, it feels mm-hmm. weird. But also like babies have been thought of as commodities in like non-surrogate arrangements as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to shift gears a little bit now and just kind of talk briefly about like where do we go from here?
Mm-hmm.
So far we've been talking about surrogacy in terms of like the surrogacy industry and kind of like feminist ethical dilemmas. But now I kind of want to talk about surrogacy's potential to kind of help create radical liberatory familiar structures. So surrogacy like complicates our definition of motherhood, like from a legal sense. And from kind of a social sense. And there can be like a real stigma and shame around infertility too. And in trying to support infertile people, we can sometimes like really heavily lean into assuring that a woman who uses a surrogate is like the real mother or the natural mother. And I totally get where there's coming from with that. But like, what if instead we took surrogacy as like complication of motherhood and like ran with it in a new direction? Like maybe surrogacy doesn't complicate the family, but kind of rather opens the door for new ways of structuring child rearing, like ones that aren't tied to like ownership and biological lineage. And again, I don't want to come across as if I am judgmental towards people who use a surrogate or people who feel a strong connection with having biological children. Like, I will not have any biological children. So in some way, I don't have any stake in the game. But I do really like this idea of using surrogacy as like an expanding starting off point for thinking mm-hmm. about families differently.
Have you read that book, Detransition Baby?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I just finished it. And it just had me thinking about a lot of these ideas of like the non-nuclear family unit and queer parenting and like what is a mother and
completely
all these things.
Yeah. And like communities have been practicing like non-nuclear family relationships like all over the world since forever. And you also have like imperialism and colonization and policing like actively trying to bar Black and brown people from participating in the nuclear family, like through mm-hmm. incarceration and forced sterilization and, you know, child protection services and whatnot. So I don't think any of us are here thinking we should really like hold on to the nuclear family. But it's also important to realize that for a lot of people, the nuclear family was never a reality. And racism was a big part of that.
Yeah. And like there's like so many cultures around the world that, you know, aren't like based in fucking white European culture. That like have always had like the word for mother is applied to like aunties and stuff mm-hmm. too. Like there isn't like this like strong delineation of like what is an aunt and what is a mother and what is a great aunt and what is a cousin, you know, like it's like more to do with like patrilineage and matrilineage and like, okay, so all your mom's sisters are also your mother. Mm-hmm. There's no word to define that. And I think that like what we were talking about last week with like how like language kind of like structures this reality is like very much, you know, we have like one word for mother and that's kind of like our limit. But I think or we only have one mother in our like nuclear family mm-hmm. unit, but there's like like many, many cultures over many, many, you know, eons that have been like using the concept of mother to talk about many other family members.
Yeah. Or have yeah. been forced to do that through, you know, enslavement and colonization mm-hmm. and stuff too. Like you have both kind of like cultures having different understandings of family and motherhood. And then you also have communities having to change the definition because their parents are being taken away from them or they are being taken mm-hmm. away from their parents.
For sure.
And so here's Angela Davis again. She has an essay that I really like called Surrogates and Outcast Mothers, Racism and Reproductive Politics in the 90s, where she talks about kind of another panic around reproduction at this time, which was kind of the rise of like the single mother, specifically the Black single mother. And so she says, quote, "The rise of single motherhood cannot be constructed, however, as synonymous with the fall of the nuclear family within Black communities, if only because it is an extremely questionable proposition that there was such an uncontested structure as the nuclear family to begin with. Historically, family relationships within Black communities have rarely coincided with the traditional nuclear model." Mm-hmm. I really want to give credit to Sophie Lewis, who wrote a book, Full Surrogacy Now, Feminism Against Family, that I've read and adore and used to kind of help me work through this episode. And she has a quote about instances of people having non-nuclear families, if you want to read it.
Sure. Okay. "Despite capitalism's worldwide hegemony, many people on Earth are putting something like full surrogacy into practice every day, cultivating non-Oedipal kinship and sharing reciprocal mothering labors between many individuals and generations. In particular, trans, Black, sex-working, migrant, and queer communities have historically survived thanks to their skills in this sphere, sometimes called kinning."
Mm-hmm. So Sophie Lewis, she writes of kind of a hypothetical future where we abolish the nuclear family and instead expand kinship networks for gestating and raising children. So I have another clip for us, which is her kind of explaining the premise of her book.
"In the commercial gestational surrogacy industry, a lack of informed consent is rife. There's a terrible lack of autonomy that workers face over their obstetric experiences. There are C-sections forced on people. There is wage skimming, underpayment, surveillance, all kinds of bad working conditions that gestational surrogates are, as workers, naming, resisting, making demands over. So why do I think that you can look at the gestational surrogacy industry, this place sort of dedicated to, you know, the most extreme expressions of propertarian biogenetic kinship? It's because the workers in that industry have experience of doing unpaid and paid pregnancy, and they have things to say about the difference, or rather the lack of a difference, between those two things. To think back to the demands of lesbian feminists, black Marxist feminists, queer feminists from the 80s, who were asserting things like all children belong to everyone. Or in the phrase of the Sisterhood of Black Single Mothers, children won't belong to patriarchy in the future, and they won't belong to us either. They will belong only to themselves. It's kind of a question of squinting at this dystopia to think about what could come beyond it if we took some of the sort of cracks and fissures in its own logic really seriously and tried to sort of peek through to sort of radically collectivized, pluralized, communized gestational reality to come.
So Sophie Lewis is coming out with a new book soon, also published through Verso, where Full Surrogacy Now is published, that's all about family abolition. And like, family abolition is like a radical idea that if people have feelings about surrogacy, like gut feelings about surrogacy, they definitely have gut feelings about family abolition. And it's like hard to wrap your head around. But also like the idea of abolishing the family, which really means like abolishing kind of like the nuclear family that we see within capitalism. you see it popping up throughout history, like with conversations around socialism and utopianism. Sophie Lewis, in introducing family abolition, kind of has a really good quote that I like that I feel like we'll use to kind of end the episode, where she goes, "Then as now, the foremost popular reaction to the proposal of abolish the family is one of gut-deep preconscious shock and horror. Even after that initial aversion has passed, sometime the objection remains, but I love my family. I don't want to abolish them. In fact, there is little in the history of family abolitionism to imply a ban on living with the people one loves. Rather, the demand one has been raised has been for universal welfare, communal luxury, queer self-determination, a classless society, and transgenerational freedom from emotional scarcity and blackmail." Hmm. And for Sophie Lewis, surrogacy, full surrogacy, is kind of the way to get there. So yeah, that's the episode.
Yeah, I mean, I love this idea, but yeah, I think like ultimately, like it just comes back to like capitalism. Yeah. And like the fact that like we live in like economic conditions that like not only favor but like require like a nuclear family unit, and just like the way our entire days and lives are structured by capitalism, and even like things like buying property, and that like it's really fucking hard to buy property as a communal, like and like just like limitations and like the actual like structures of society that like prevent sort of like queer or like communal parenting and like family units and stuff. So yeah, I feel like I'm not sure which has to come before the other, but like I feel like, yeah, to understand sort of like deconstructing the family unit has to, yeah, also deconstructing like a capitalist society altogether.
And it's interesting that in some people's envisioning of like when the revolution comes, like a better future for us, where we don't have capitalism anymore, the idea of the family does not being changed is just not something they think about. And I wonder if in part that has to do with stuff around reproduction and families and, again, like kind of things that are anti-capitalism.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No. And like, I love the idea of like, I don't know, I think like what a more like you always hear people talk about like how kind of like isolating motherhood mm-hmm. can be, you know, and like what better way to like enact like a more like communal parenting style than like to actually be like surrounded by like a community of people that are like have like a share a similar vision yeah. and are doing a similar thing. Yeah, I also I would love to live in a world where like if someone wants to be a single parent, they can just like do that without like facing steep economic barriers mm-hmm. Because having a child is so fucking expensive, you know?
And I do think also like there's for me, there was something really wonderful about reading of this kind of imagined or, you know, realized space of kind of expanded families as mm-hmm. someone who's looking down the barrel of not being able to produce their own biological family necessarily. Mm-hmm. Sure. Like I've joked so much about like, oh, I'm going to be like the cool, fun aunt or something. But, you know, I do hope as an adult that I am able to cultivate like really, you know, deep, meaningful relationships with children, you know, mm-hmm. with if my sister chooses to have children or if my friends choose to have children, you know, like, and I think it's really important for kids to have a, you know, a grown-up figure who isn't their parent who they can come to.
Definitely. So yeah,
it makes,
and I feel like this used to like be a thing, like, you know, when families would kind of like stay within like a similar geographical region, like you know, like maybe you had multiple brothers and sisters and maybe you'd move away from the family home, but you'd live just down the street mm-hmm. yeah. or like on like the same plot of land. And then like your kids are just kind of running around and like maintain like super close relationships to like people of like multiple age demographics and like multiple like kind of relationships to them. But it's not like, you know, you're just in a silo with your biological parents. And I feel like the like sort of the straying away from that sort of more community child rearing has like caused a whole bunch of issues in children's lives.
Yeah. Well, that's all I got for you.
Thanks for an episode.
Oh, thank you. And we will see you next month.
Yes.
For Horn Month.
Horn Month.